Hello and thank you for listening to Upstart. Upstart is a project by community builders of Startup Weekend in Greater China. And we talk with inspiring leaders and founders from the region about their work and projects. This week, we're talking with Felix. Felix Wong is an entrepreneur and community builder. He has been a great advocate for Startup Weekend in Hong Kong. And Felix and I will be sharing 5 books each, the ones that had a big impact on us. So please sit back and listen. Felix, first question, how do you pick a book that you want to read?
First thing first, I usually get recommendation from friends, from colleagues, or even whenever I search online, like some popular online bookstores, Amazon, book depositories, or even blog posts from entrepreneurs or startup program where they always put up 7 books you need to read before you become an entrepreneur, 5 books you need to read to land your successful funding. So all of these recommendations.
Like the Bill Gates list of books to read, the McKinsey list to be a better consultant, and the Andreessen. That's cool. And do you use any tool to track the books that you read?
Honest speaking, for me, I'm not a big fan of digital and ebooks. Hence, I didn't use any applications or software to track as well as reading. I'm a big fan of physical books, like a bookshelf behind.
Your parents must be so happy.
They're so happy, obviously. Yeah, they're not seeing all the figures, toys, but books. But yeah, there are a couple of reasons why I prefer physical books over digital books, because I feels like on application or software, there are kind of lots of distractions sometimes. And not good for eyes, secondly, if you focus on your screen too long.
Yeah.
And on digital books, I'm not sure if you feel the same. People usually skip a bunch of content instead of reading from start to from the beginning to end. So I prefer, for that all this reason, I prefer physical book where I can really concentrate myself with a coffee, just, you know, have fun with the book.
That's interesting, because I found that So because I've been taking the plane so much and moving in and out from apartments, carrying books was always a major challenge. So I've actually become accustomed in reading on my Kindle. So I actually have 3 places, 3 kind of tools. So I have paper books, but fewer and fewer. I use the Kindle, and then on my iPad, I use the book application. When I have like long PDFs and sorts of things. I agree with you. It's not like the best way, but typically on the plane, when you have big luggages already, having just a Kindle, opening it up, it's not forbidden on China Eastern, right? The iPad, you cannot use it when you're taking off and landing, but the Kindle works. And that helps me kind of carry so many different books, and I can switch easily and sorts of things.
Yeah.
And man, when do you find time to read? Because you're pretty busy these days, these months, these years, your entire life. So when do you find time to sit down and?
I usually read during 3 time slots, I would say. Number one, in the morning, I usually read on my way to a commute for work, for meeting. Maybe just me, because I'm living far from the city. So I usually take maybe 45 to an hour commute. So it's really common for me, and I can usually manage to kill a chapter during my commute, so it's a good time. And I don't really focus on my phone when I commute, so instead I choose book versus film. Secondly, when I'm eating alone, I will read without, you know, anyone beside me. I just pick a corner, really focus on readings, and the other hand with a fog at the same time.
Yeah.
Other than that, my third time slot will be usually before I sleep. So I might read a couple of pages or a chapter.
And I see the books behind you that you actually read in English. Doesn't that like get you to fall asleep a lot faster? Because when I don't read in French, but in English, it took time to get used to it. And after just like two pages, I would start to kind of...
So in terms of my collections, most of the books are business, entrepreneurial, or psychology related. And I found that most of the Chinese translation, they are not 100% appropriate. So that's why I pick English. Secondly, it's not my first language, and I can obviously learn from how people write, how people describe something in the language which I'm not familiar with. So that's why I read English books.
But you don't find that it was a problem at first? Like it was, how did you cope with the fact that it was not your mother tongue?
I won't say it's a problem, but more towards a learning for myself. Of course, I tried to read Chinese or Cantonese book or Taiwanese as well. But I fall asleep easily on Chinese books than English books.
And have you tried listening to books like the Audible and Crazy?
I try, but I'm not a big fan of listening to something like long time. I'm okay with listening to music, movie, but if someone reading a book, I would prefer a real person in front of me than an audiobook.
Yeah. Interesting. So I'd like to talk about a book that you've actually used during so many of your own workshops, especially the one around either customer discovery or when it comes to prototyping, and it's the Airbnb story by Leigh Gallagher. I'm probably saying it wrong, but can you say what you liked about it?
So I learned a couple of things on this book. First of all, why I picked this book, or Airbnb, is definitely a good reference, kind of Bible idols for all the entrepreneurs and founders. And this book is written by a third person, not from the founders, but it's kind of a person where they authorize to follow the founders super close, where they capture their day-to-day life, how they manage a business, and eventually become a buddies. So these books really taught me about the idea of lean startup, first of all. I learned lean startup from this book instead of the lean startup. So this book illustrates lots of good terminologies about why entrepreneurs should start something from small, but not, you know, very visionary, you know, sort of idea, ambitious. It's okay to have, but this book taught me the reason behind why you should always focus on the problems, the customers, and eventually how do you build your company step by step to become a big venture. And I think it might not be relevant to the workshops I usually run, but their second thing I learned from this book, which I usually talk to my friends about, is about the culture of Airbnb. It's really relevant for companies who are growing pretty fast and have a certain amounts, maybe hundreds of employees. So one thing I learned from a chapter, I forgot which chapter, but they taught me like the first 300 employees of Airbnb are employed by the three co-founders. So meaning that before the first 300 employees on board, they don't have any hiring manager or HR department. If you think about it, the reason behind, the founders really want to encourage the company to maintain a culture where they share similar, you know, interests, hobbies, or they speak the same language, at least the first 300 employees, because it's really crucial for fast-growing startups to maintain, to grow, to penetrate into different cities, no matter it's for business perspective, marketing, have fun. It's good to have a big group of people who share the similar thinking, right? So I really learned from this chapter to talk about how they pick the right person, how they make sure the company is following a culture, and eventually become a big company.
Interesting.
Super recommended.
That's really cool. Can you say again the author? Oh, yeah.
You got it?
Yeah.
Cool.
Data is sharing about the fact that he learned also some chunks of the story from his time at the Beijing YC Startup School.
Yeah, and the third thing I learned from this book, and I think it's also a good suggestions or recommendation, especially for new founders, particularly for non-tech founders. So Airbnb actually founded by two design graduates where they don't have any tech backgrounds. They 100% started their business from WordPress, from scratch, without super comprehensive technology, searching, back then nothing fancy. And they spent around 1.5 years before they had the first CTO. So I learned from this group of people where they really focus on the problems they want to solve, start from small, lean, really tackle the problem, what users need. Back then, they started a business from having this idea tied with a tech conference where the hostel hotels overbook, and then they sort of an idea, why not we reach out apartments owners where they have free space and able to free up, you know, maybe a mattress or sofa, things like that, which just a very simple WordPress template. No coding, no technology, no JavaScript, but just two design graduates where they really think from the users, and eventually they able to build up the company, get some money, and hire the developers.
Yeah. Interesting. Thank you for sharing. And so maybe I can share the book that I picked, which is Principles, Life and Work from Ray Dalio. I'm going to share the link, in the chat. And I don't know if you've heard about Principles or Ray Dalio. Ray Dalio is an entrepreneur and investor in the US. And the book really gave me an extremely clear perspective on what's the link between your values and your actions. There is something actually in between that are called the principles. And without knowing, you have hundreds of those principles. You as an individual, but also the organization that you work in. And it is extremely insightful to visualize that. So kind of assess what are your own principles and write them down somewhere so that, you know, you make more sense of the actions that you are taking. And so the book is great at giving you a framework. Well, first explaining why you should be identifying your own principles. Then he gives you some instructions on building yours for yourself. And then he gives you like almost 300 or 400 of their own principles, that the ones that they are using within his firm. And it's extremely powerful because by doing this introspection work, you do get to learn a lot about yourself. And by looking, you know, at my past behaviors or the way, you know, I'm working in teams, et cetera, I was able to identify these patterns and extract from the patterns, the principles that now make so much more sense when I'm facing a situation. There is one, for example, which is my relationship to trust. I have a tendency of trusting people, right? At the first, you know, encounter, you know, you have my trust. You have my trust until you break it. And then once you break it, it's going to be so hard for somebody to get my trust back. And, you know, this is my principle, right? I'm not claiming it's for everybody, but finally acknowledging it and having it somewhere gave me so much more peace whenever I'm dealing with a situation where somebody broke, you know, my trust. That was super powerful. I'm now doing it with leadership, public speaking, selling, my own dreams and goals. So I'm super recommending this book if you haven't had a look at it yet.
Sounds good. So speaking of principles, do you have any idea from the book or the author from an entrepreneur's perspective, how do we make better decisions?
Yeah, that's a good, great question. So I found that, you know, as an entrepreneur, you get more and more stressed, right? You really get pushed towards your limits, because the stakes are getting higher, because the pressure is getting higher, because you're always in survival mode. And you may be starting to act in autopilot, and that might lead you to making some weird decisions or decisions that you would not be confident with. But by knowing your principles, you kind of empower yourself to, first of all, know when it's time to have a pause and kind of reflect back on what you stand for, what you care about. But at the same time, when you're really struggling in making decisions, you can look back into your principles and feel kind of your comfort zone and figuring out, you know, what might be the good way for yourself. So for these two reasons, I think entrepreneurs have a lot to gain by understanding their principles. I know that, you know, when I was freaking out or looking at the strategy for our region, I was kind of, or for example, when things were not making so much sense anymore, I was looking back at the principles, and that was helping me look back into how I was making decisions. And that was super helpful, actually.
Interesting.
The second book that you picked is very interesting, and I would not necessarily have assumed that you would have picked this one. And it's The Promise of a Pencil, How an Ordinary Person Can Create Extraordinary Change by Adam Brown. Can you tell us about this book? And
this is amazing. So maybe just a little background about the author. So this book is written by the founder of this company, which is on a first person basis. So the founder called Adam Brown, and apparently he's the only author I've been connected on LinkedIn where we share, you know, sharing messages right now. A long time ago is I actually read this book two years and a half ago, and then after this book I connected the founder on LinkedIn, and then we sharing some insights about entrepreneurship, things like that. And he was the founder of the a non-profit organization called Promise of a Pencil. Right now he stepped out and he hired a new CEO to lead the company. It's a 7 years old, really fast growing and meaningful startups. 2 years ago, after he exited the company, he founded another company called Mission U, which is non-traditional / non-tuition university to support minority where they can learn, get knowledge, and, you know, like normal people graduate from schools. And last year we were acquired a company and then called WeGrow. And right now Adam Brown is the CEO of WeGrow under WeWork. So what I learned from this book, I would say three things. Number one, Adam Brown used to be an ordinary person where he had really successful education background, from graduate from Brown, and then right after graduation he started his career at Bain. So really good, you know, kind of progress, good tier one institutions, number one management consulting company. And at some point he realized something where his career and work environment couldn't satisfy himself, and he started travel, and he ended up traveling as a backpacker across the world. And he not only traveling, but he's kind of following a mission to find his passions. And every time when he dropped by a city, he will ask a kid something like, what do you want to achieve? What do you want to learn? What do you want? Blah, 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 etc. And one day when he reached India, like rural area, he asked a kid, what do you want? And eventually the kid told him, I want a pencil. And this is how all the stories begin. He realized a lot of minorities or kids, they are lack of support from schools, knowledge, education, all these things. So that's why he started the Promise of a Pencil, which is a non-profit organization where they build schools by having a platform online, gathering money, allows people to lead charity campaign and build schools, this kind of concepts. And the second thing I learned from this book is they talk about very interesting positions in between startups, social enterprise, and non-profit organization. And I believe these three items always confuse some maybe social entrepreneurs or maybe people who have the social entrepreneurial mindset, how they should position themselves, whether they need to start a startup, a charity, or maybe a social enterprise. And interestingly, the Pencil of a Promise doesn't fall into these three categories. And he initiated a new category called for-purpose organizations, where they're kind of describing a company where they do things for good, at the same time making profit to sustain and grow a company. Very similar to big corporations, but it kind of inspired me a lot. Sometimes, especially startups, it's okay to not tie with a strict categories, but really have your own thing. And the third item I learned from this book is, I think he is the only entrepreneurs or social entrepreneurs having Justin Bieber as his ambassador.
That's a clear win.
It's a clear win, and I like Justin Bieber to the sense his music, his talents, but the way he worked with Bieber is very inspiring as well, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, this organization is the only organization Justin Bieber devoted a lot of time and money-wise, time-wise, resources-wise as well. So long story short, not to mention a lot, but I do really recommend this book if you are decided to start organizations with a mission.
Mm-hmm.
Solving a real problem, especially under the, you know, the United Nations SDG categories, this might inspire you a lot.
Yeah. That's really cool, man.
Yeah. That's really cool.
I'll jump in with a book that's a lot more practical. I like actually that we alternate between the different stories. Let me share the link in the chat. It's called Traction. And it's probably the book that I've referred the most to entrepreneurs around me, the ones that I've been mentoring, because it is so important for people to understand that finding customers has techniques and has a framework that you can use. So the general thesis of this book is that you have somewhere like 16 to 19 different channels to look for traction. So you have SEO, going to conferences, direct sales, you have content marketing, et cetera, et cetera. And basically, he gives you the framework to first figure out what's the best for you, and then he describes all your different options. So the framework that he tells to entrepreneurs and the one that I share with the one I mentor is that you need to pick the top three that you believe are going to create, you know, a good outcome. And you start doing them. You focus on these three only, and you try to clearly measure, you know, what are the outcomes with each channel, right? So, for example, going to conferences, direct sales, and content marketing. And after a certain period of time, right, that could be a sprint, that could be a longer period, whatever, you measure the one that's going to be the most successful. And that becomes your benchmark. And either the last one or the other two, you cannot switch them with other channels. And you keep running these experiments. Of course, the top one, the benchmark, you can still grow it because eventually you also want to grow the business. But you don't have to because you're in that discovery stage of your startup. But anyway, you start basically figuring out how do you really look for traction from your market, right? How do you find your customers? What's the message, et cetera? And I really like this mindset of having a system for people, for entrepreneurs, to look for their customers. He also mentions that your channels are going to change as you grow your business, as you have access to more resources, as you expand geographically, and you should always keep testing, keep iterating. And that's why it's super helpful. He's giving also a bunch of different growth hacking techniques. So again, I think I recommended it again a month and a half ago to a group of entrepreneurs who were all over the place. I don't know if you've had entrepreneurs telling you that, you know, they grew, they got a few customers without doing marketing and stuff. And all of these, right, you put the book into their hands, they realize that, you know, what they've been doing all along was struggling to really have a clear, systematic approach to customer acquisition, and that's super helpful.
Cool. Can you elaborate more when we talk about attractions? Who will rely on these metrics among the sellers or maybe the stakeholders around?
So you mean within the founding team or what?
Yeah. From a startup perspective, who will read the attractions, like the metrics?
So you know, it's typically, this book is applicable when you've identified your product market fit. You're at a certain stage where it's really about you growing the business. So you may have a growing, like a growth hacking team. You may have a BD team. But at the end of the day, it's so important also for the co-founders to understand how to find customers, especially at the beginning. You were talking about the Airbnb founding team. I'm pretty sure they were really hands-on understanding the channels that they, you know, they were leveraging to acquire more and more customers. So I would say the founding team needs to be extremely hands-on with figuring out where to find customers, because that's probably a question that investors will want to understand, that, you know, the smart money, right, they would probably open doors for you in the different channels that might be helpful. But of course, if you have a growth hacking team, if you have a BD team, they should also understand the fact that there is not just one way to hunt for customers, because that's probably one of the worst mistakes you can do. I had a conversation with a mobile app entrepreneur who was swearing by Facebook AdWords. The guy was convinced, and I really wanted him to understand that. Yeah, that's one way, but there are, you know, a dozen of other ways. And, you know, if you want Facebook to be your benchmark, that's great. But as a founder, you almost have the duty to look for more performing or cheaper or faster, whatever, channels to get traction.
Sounds good.
So you also picked a third book, and that's the one that I'm the most curious about. It's called Chaos Monkeys, Obscene Fortune and Random Failure in Silicon Valley. And I'll also paste the book in the chat. So if you guys want to open Goodreads, feel free to do so. Look at the cover.
Great. Right here. I'm ready. So, this is the book I recently completed, and it's quite thick. Actually, it's 450 pages, so it takes some time for me to, you know, really read it through. If you're looking for this book, they have a new cover recently, so make sure you search the name and also the author at the same time. So, long story short, if people are recommending the Lean Startup 0-1 as kind of the first two Bibles for entrepreneurs, I would say this is the third Bible for new founders. Why? Because this book answers a lot of questions during your startup journey. No matter you're at the early stage, fundraising, accelerators, going back to corporates, got acquired, this book answered all these questions from a first person perspective. Just a little background about the author. So arguably in Silicon Valley, people describe this person as 100%, no, 200% asshole. Typical entrepreneurs, badass, messing up with a lot of people. doing something good, doing bad, have sex and all these things, you know, drinking, drugs, whatever. But that's the fact, right? That's true. This always happening, no matter from which industry. But what I learned from this book is, interestingly, this guy also started as an ordinary person, good school, good company, bankers, quit, join a startup, you know, like typical entrepreneurs, right? And eventually started his own. And this book illustrates a lot how entrepreneurs' obstacle looks like, especially lawsuits from the previous employer where you're kind of stealing data, this kind of thing, how they tackle this issue. Secondly, forming a co-founding team, visa issue, because some of the co-founders are not, they don't have the permission to work in the United States. This book talk about how does it make it happen. And the company of the founder also got into the Y Combinator as well, which is one of the leading startup accelerator by program. And luckily these founders and the startup also got funded by a bunch of amazing angel investors.
Mm-hmm.
Inside program like Chris Tucker, also mm-hmm. the investor of Twitter and Facebook. And long story short, besides all the startups ups and down story, this book actually consists around 40% of the content describing how this guy jumping from all the way from lay off the acquisition agreement from Twitter by joining Facebook. So this is really interesting. If you're talking about so this story like is like 4 or 5 years ago when the two companies are not super big, giant yet. It's like still super strong in terms of competitions. So this book talk about how the founders work with acquiring a lot of startups in the valley before they're going too big, and how does all the technologies now we are using is becoming from an idea all the way to become a cash cow right now.
Mm-hmm.
So it also answers a lot of terminologies from the social media and digital marketing side as well. And this book did a great job. Yeah.
Do you think it would be possible to have such a lifestyle in Hong Kong or in Beijing or Singapore?
I think that the lifestyle is really intense when I was reading this book, because this book also put up the kind of the schedule.
Yeah.
The calendar dates on each chapter, and I would say everything comes really, really fast.
Yeah.
So, and if I put myself into the story, I have no idea how I should handle all these incidents happening at the same time. But yeah, that's the real life. If you want to, if you have the courage to become a successful or badass entrepreneur, this might be the roller coasters you're going to ride.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
So from story to more practical things, I'd like to talk about a third book that I've been recommending also quite a lot. It's not necessarily a fun one. It's called Venture Deals, written by Brad Feld, who I know you've been hearing a lot about when it comes to startup communities and his insights on investing. Venture Deals is probably the one that I recommend to every entrepreneur looking into raising money. It's not a book that you're reading in the evening hoping to have a good story from. It's super thick. It's almost brutal to read. There are many terms that are legal related, finance related, but it's so important for founders raising money to really understand the different terms that would most likely be brought up by their angels or investors. So I don't have a lot to share, but I wanted to put it, you know, kind of out there, because if you have entrepreneurs who are asking you for suggestions on how to raise money, I would say that they should start doing the homework early, and that include understanding the sorts of terms that, you know, people might expect them to sign. Way too often I'm seeing, you know, either entrepreneurs or first-time employees making terrible decisions because they are just too trustful or too excited into getting, you know, shares or money. So doing homework is really, really key.
Yeah, I agree. I didn't read the book, but I took the online course by Kaufman Academy, yeah, which is also the foundation of Venture Deals. And I would also recommend, if there is any angel investors watching our video, this is the Bible for you, where it talk about a lot of terminologies in practice. For example, cap table, founders agreement, term sheets, how does the funding cycle and recycling funding looks like. And if you're not really working on all these things, there's no chance you will understand in a short period of time. So I would say, like, yeah.
Really, you're right, actually. It's also for investors to be more educated and more mature about investing in startups.
Yep.
Yeah, because it's different than real estate and financial problems. Your fourth book is one that I read and I enjoyed. It's called Designed to Grow, How Coca-Cola Learned to Combine Scale and Agility by David Butler. Can you tell us about it?
Cool. So this book is written by the former head of design of Coca-Cola, which is the product we use almost every time when we have party, drinking, from kids. And I'm sure there's no one in the world, they never had a Coca-Cola before. But in short, what does the associations look like from me as a reader to entrepreneurships and to the interesting fact this book is talking about is how do we scale a company or a brand in a more systematic way. And after reading this book, I think the conclusion is really standardize everything and making sure your peer, your colleagues, or your stakeholder following the similar structure of the standardizations. Because if you refer to Coca-Cola, obviously, it's a Coke, it's a soft drinks. But when you look at the Coca-Cola in Hong Kong versus Japan, Bangkok, you might realize there's something similar, but at the same time, very different. Not to mention the taste, but maybe the packaging, maybe the advertisement. I'm sure you might come across some advertisements on the bus, airport, whatever. They put up a lot of localizations, like content, like having different ways to represent the advertisements. But if you go step back a little, look at how they put together all the color schemes, the tone of the codes, or even the videos, you might realize a lot of similarities. And all these things, in short, is what this author is trying to illustrate, the standardizations. So from an entrepreneur's perspective, or people who want to start up, or you are in a stage where ready to tap into different markets, making sure you have a scheme, or maybe principle as well. Really standardize everything. Go back, look at your growth, whether different stakeholders are following the original idea, I would say. Yeah.
How do you balance this with iterations?
I would say iterations is more... associated with data collections. Because whenever you think about iterations, meaning that there might be something not right or too slow, where you need a new strategies or a new form of business operations. When we talk about standardization, I would say it's more like a process. Let's take Scrum Board or Sprint as an example. You won't change too much, maybe a 5-day sprint. But in between, there are something small elements where you can iterate a little and make it better for different cities or maybe business units.
Interesting.
Yeah. And by the way, this book, he mentions Saturday weekends and texts us 5 times.
That's right.
I found it.
Yeah, I think I took a picture somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's saying that it's one of the best ways for entrepreneurs to start.
Yeah, he's also a big fan of Saturday weekend as well. I think he joined it as a mentor. I don't know where and when, but yes, that's why he mentioned.
We should track this down. Yeah, I remember a paragraph where he's saying that entrepreneurs can start extremely quickly by attending a startup weekend in India.
Yes, like, India.
I knew.
Yeah.
The book that I'm going to talk about next. Yeah, absolutely, Dana. That should be a must read. I agree. Good promotion. It's Scaling, and it's by Reid Hoffman, the founder of LinkedIn. And this book is both extremely pragmatic, brutal, but also very elegant. It's the idea that certain startups have almost the mandate to grow as fast as they can. And as a result, things are going to be broken in the path of that startup scaling super fast, right? Blitz scaling comes from the idea of blitz, which is like super fast in German, I guess, and scaling, which is growing, right? So you try to grow as fast as you can. And it's really inspiring because he is both explaining why it's happening, how it's happening, and what can founders do about it. And he gives some suggestions on hiring, on firing, on looking for partners, on raising money. And that's super hands-on, but also very aspirational. He's explaining the pros and cons of being a founder in a blitzscaling startup, of being an employee in the blitzscaling startup. And that really, really gave me an inspiring look into what are the things that actually some entrepreneurs in mainland China or in Hong Kong might not be doing super well. It feels sometimes, and I would love to have another conversation around this, that as soon as some founders find product market fit, they may struggle having that mindset of belief scaling, right? So they found a product market fit, raise a bit of money, and who should read the books? Yeah, so totally like founders and mentors helping founders who have that desire of becoming a unicorn. Let's use buzzwords. I'm crazy. So very often, you know, there is that idea that there is a pause or people start being so much, difficult about, you know, what they want to achieve. Basically, they kind of let it down a little bit. And I found this disappointing. Whereas you should keep like growing like a crazy person. I don't know if it's a more Silicon Valley mindset or if we can really replicate this. I know that there are Chinese startups that are blitzscaling like crazy, but how do we bring this also to entrepreneurs that come out of Startup Weekend or that are joining PropUp or other programs, right? How do we make sure that they start with an idea, they fight like crazy to figure out product market fit, they understand their traction channels, and how do we make sure that they become unicorn within a couple of years rather than, you know, decades?
Sounds interesting.
Yeah, man. Yeah, I really like it, actually. It's a very easy read. It's not an old book at all. So he's using a bunch of cool examples. So yeah, it's something that you could read on an airplane, on the train, because that's really easy. The final book that you picked, and I also had a look at it, I like it, is the $100 Startup, Reinvent the Way You Make a Living, Do What You Love and Create a New Future by Chris Guillebeau, I guess.
Yeah, by Guillebeau. There we go. So, background about this book, the author, Chris, was a journalist and become an entrepreneur. And, beside the 100 startups, he also have, two really interesting books. It's like a series, but not. The first one is called The Happy Parasite. And the second book is The 100 Startup. And his, recently launched book is called Side Hustle.
Ooh.
I'm sure it's a buzzword, so, but for now, let's talk about the 100 Startups and who should read this book. First of all, I would definitely recommend entrepreneurs. But secondly, I think they're kind of an emerging and more people becoming independent freelancers, digital nomads who really want to start something aside or maybe have their own freelancing, consulting, or e-commerce businesses. And this book is really, really good for people who are trying to devote himself to become a digital nomad, travel whilst working. And as I mentioned, he was a journalist traveling, and he realized while traveling, he can make some money and sustain his life, travels, all the budget cover, but at the same time, do really make aggressive revenues as well. So a lot of best practice in the book, not really super difficult and rocket science-focused startups, high tech, but really something down to earth and making money. And of course, I got caught by the headline of the book, like 100 US dollars. Is it really possible? I would say after reading this book, yes, because they really talk about something kind of trading your knowledge, selling something simple, easy, where people might buy it, but without a lot of considerations. For example, you after 3-5 years, you might collect a bunch of entrepreneurial experience, some skill sets where you want to share. And he talked about how an entrepreneur should put all these things in context and make it as an ebook where people might download, get attractions. People might not suddenly get a book from the websites, but eventually you might get some passive income on being a speaker from a conference, right? And this book is kind of educating something like a magnet, how we attract people to following your content, make money, and building his visibility as well. Good for digital nomad. Amazing.
That's a book for Keith.
Yeah, Keith.
Keith, it's for you. Yeah. And oh, you read loud. Okay, cool. And my final book is called Thanks for the Feedback. Data also. Thanks for the feedback. The science of art of receiving feedback well. So it's obviously not just for entrepreneurs. It's for pretty much any friends, spouse, partners, moms, dads, teachers, boss, employees. I was really not good at this, both at receiving and giving feedback. And by reading it, by really doing an effort on myself to understand what was the main points, and by starting to implement some of the concrete examples that they write about, really helped me a lot. And I've been using my wife as a guinea pig on many times to try how to give her some feedback and receiving feedback. And there are many small tricks that sometimes we feel are like a little overstretched, but actually work super, super well. And I feel like in our circles, we are sometimes a little overly positive about things and what we're trying to build. And I'm forcing myself, and I think I'm going to start sharing the book around to actually be a lot more honest. So I think that book might be tied with Radical Candor, for example. But Thanks for the Feedback has a framework, canned approach, answers, and techniques to be cool at giving and receiving feedback. So really, really a must read, especially as you're trying to grow a team, especially as things are starting to break around you. And especially if you're trying to learn from other people and about yourself. So super recommended.
Nice.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate how this, because you mentioned you're using Yayi as a guinea pig, like it's like feedback from one person to another. When we talk about feedback, how does feedback really help an organization?
I believe I probably forgot that part. I don't know if he's mentioned, if they are mentioning it. They really work on the one-to-one approach. And they mentioned, for example, that it's important first to understand if the person is ready to welcome feedback. They give you a couple of strategies to identify this. And something that I started to do is, do you allow me to provide you with some feedback? Right? That this is something that you might feel sounds crazy, but I've really seen people switching a lot their immediate reply when I first ask for their permission. And I've been able to A/B test, you know, like asking for permission, not asking for permission, and asking for permission is awesome. Then the second thing is the way you frame the feedback, right? And so I've realized, especially with Yali, that if I direct it at her, not working. If I talk about us, suddenly it works. It's crazy, the small change and the impact that it has. And then there is, how do you make sure that the feedback is understood and what to do if it's not? So I guess at the scale of an organization, probably empowering everybody, not just the managers, but also the individual contributors, to understand how to take feedback and how to give feedback is probably super helpful. So the amount of information doesn't just go from the top to the bottom during the bullshit annual reviews, but like on an ongoing basis, giving heads up, providing on-the-spot feedback or not, is super helpful. I think if you want to build a culture of trust, of open doors and open mindset and sort of things.
Nice.
Yeah, recommended. It's not it's kind of long. It's like 300 something pages, but again, it's so practical that you have things to use pretty quickly. Now, the next question is, you know, is it applicable in the Chinese culture? I always take a grain of salt when it comes to American, productivity or self-management tools books. But I feel like, in some ways, the Americans have kind of mastered these concepts. And there are things that we can kind of cherry pick and use on even in this part of the world.